This is a sermon about sex. Books on public speaking encourage you to engage your listeners with an arresting opening remark. Get their attention. So I hope you're gripped and not horrified. In many ways, I wish, frankly, it wasn't a sermon about sex. Because when you add to sex, divorce and remarriage, there are probably no group of issues which touch quite as many deep feelings or raw nerves. And there is certainly no area, friends, in which it is easier for a person to be a pulpit phony than this one. Lecturing other people as if you've got it all sorted out yourself when you haven't. It doesn't take an expert to recognize our society's obsession with sex. It's the most talked about and thought about subject in contemporary Western society. It's oversold and undervalued. It's portrayed as the route to intimacy, security, and significance on the one hand, and on the other as little more than enjoyable and fleeting recreation. Devoid of meaning and even love. Sexuality is an important aspect of our very humanity, isn't it? We express it in a host of ways other than merely through sexual intercourse. It's there in how we relate to one another. It's there in caring, in giving, in touch, in sensual pleasure, in giving and receiving affection, in friendship, in communication. Properly understood, it's part of what it means to be a human being in God's image. He has made us this way. Angels may be sexless, but we human beings are not. When God made us, he gave us bodies. He made us male and female. So to talk about sex is to talk about something very close to the center of our personalities and beings. Our bodies and what we do with them matter. They're full of eternal significance, according to the New Testament. It was to the sexually charged Corinthian society that Paul taught that the body is meant for the Lord, 1 Corinthians 6:13. It's God's temple. It was to the Romans that he argued that the body was the very dwelling place of God's Spirit, Romans 8:9. And yet these bodies of ours have the capacity, don't they, to be deliciously stimulated and aroused and to respond at times and in ways which are hard to contain or control. Sometimes hard to believe that God has made us this way, but he has. And not to recognize this is a little bit like the church which advertised a series of morning sermons entitled The Seven Deadly Sins Omitting Lust. But it's a reality. It's part of what we are as fallen, sinful, sexual human beings. Do you know that the most powerful sexual organs that we have are not in our underwear? They're in our heads, our minds. That's where our most powerful sexual drives originate. The late Malcolm Muggeridge once quipped, "The English have sex on the brain, a particularly unfortunate place to have it." And of course he was right. I've been amused this week by an advertisement at my local tube station. It was there one morning, it hadn't been there the morning before, and it was there the next morning. There's a rather attractive, scantily clad female sunbather lying on a towel. Below the caption, "What man doesn't think about it every 6 seconds?" And then further down, "It's the most important game of your life." Well, of course, we're meant to think, and we do, sex. And men immediately twig that well-known spoof statistic about our one-track minds. Turns out that the advertisement is for a football computer game called Championship Manager. But the double entendre is clever. So sexual advertising so often is clever. And the point is made. Well, let me reassure anyone who's concerned that personally, I hardly ever think about football management. But you know, it's this aspect of sex in the mind, that Jesus turns to in our passage tonight on the Sermon on the Mount. Here is the Lord in the greatest sermon ever preached, exploring the true ethical standards of the kingdom. Here is the manifesto of the kingdom for Christian people. And in some breathtaking paragraphs, six paragraphs, Jesus, unassailable personal authority, comes through. Here is the fulfiller of all that the Old Testament law meant. Here is what it pointed to. Here is Jesus spelling out the permanent, definitive, non-negotiable reality of its demands. Here is the Lord's call to all-time ethics, to kingdom values, to heart and mind religion. Religion which pleases God and is consistent with the law of love. Well, we looked last week with Rico Tice at the way in which Jesus explored the sixth commandment against murder, and we saw that in reality that extended to and embraced anger, the seed thought from which all murder and violence ultimately stem. This week, we move in verse 27 to the seventh commandment against adultery, and perhaps too with an intentional glance at the tenth commandment. For someone who commits adultery certainly first covets another person's partner. In the Bible, it's the basic rule of sexuality: no adultery allowed. It's there. And it's there to protect marriage. It doesn't ensure that a marriage will be a good marriage. It's just a strong wall built around a marriage, protecting a married couple from an alien and evil force that breaks the essential one-flesh unity, which is a marriage. And when you go outside that wall, says the Bible, you may never come back in one piece. But the basic rule by Jesus' time had grown rather too narrow. You may know that old joke about the divorcee giving evidence who told the judge, "I never knew what adultery was until I met my solicitor." You see, the average Old Testament male was fairly clear that he knew what adultery was. Adultery was something his wife did when she had intercourse with somebody else. The same did not quite apply to him. Oh, if he had sex with another married woman, he was guilty of adultery against her husband. But if he went to bed with a single girl, or maybe a prostitute, well, that was, well, just sex, really. Sounds dangerously familiar, doesn't it? And Jesus blows all that apart by making two startling intensifications of the seventh commandment. First of all, he says in verses 27 and 30, you can commit mental adultery. And then secondly, in verses 31 and 32, divorce and remarriage may equate to adultery. Now, those two things made people bristle then, and they still make people bristle today when we spell them out like that. So first of all, mental adultery. The root of sexual unfaithfulness, insists Jesus, is not to be found in the genitals, it's to be found in the mind and the heart. So no married man should pat himself on the back for avoiding an affair if he is secretly taking the pretty girl next door to bed in his vivid imagination. You see, the scribes and the Pharisees taught that as long as you kept away from the narrowly defined adultery, you were okay. But Jesus refuses to stop there, and his standards are high, and he looks beyond the externals to heart and mind-based purity. It's a bigger thing. Verse 28, "But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." U.S. former President Jimmy Carter was and is a strong Christian. He caused consternation in 1980 in an interview in Playboy magazine when he admitted publicly that he was guilty of this very sin. There was baffled consternation. The liberal media establishment concluded that he had finally flipped. And some commentators even felt that it contributed to his loss of the presidency in 1980. But, you know, who of us, married or single, has not known lust at some time or other? What Mr. Carter was admitting? Any of us, most of us, maybe all of us, could admit at some time or other. Who of us can say that their thought life is fully under control? That we've never undressed somebody in our minds? Or thought of another person as a sex object? Or treated another person as a visual or emotional prostitute? Or enjoyed what psychiatrist John White calls the secret delights in the brothels of our hearts? Well, I certainly have. Typical, says someone, typical. Another repressed Christian hung up about sex. No, Jesus is not here condemning sexual feelings or longings. He's certainly not writing off erotic attraction. We need to be attracted to and excited by one another. That's the way we're made. We wouldn't get together at all if that didn't happen. So that's not what Jesus is talking about. He's not even talking, I suspect, about sexual fantasy. Because although all lust involves sexual fantasy, not all sexual fantasy leads directly to lust. So we need not be paralyzed by fear of erotic experience. Inside marriage or outside it. Nor is Jesus saying that it's wrong to be tempted. Of course not. He, Jesus, was tempted in every way, just as we are, Hebrews 4, verse 15. But he never sinned. See, there's all the difference in the world between being tempted to sin sexually and yielding to that pressure. The problem is that temptation and sin are on the same track, so we can never be complacent. And experience tells us that lustful feelings can sometimes sweep over us in the most alarming way and in the most inappropriate places. See, mental adultery happens anywhere. That's the problem. It can happen at work. It can happen with your neighbors. It can happen at a Bible study. It can happen in church. It can happen at a worship service. And it occurs when what may begin as a flicker of interest or attraction somehow grows and spirals into what Dr. Dick France calls the deliberate harboring of desire for an illicit relationship. And, you know, we usually know it when we feel it, that sort of sexual stew that can overtake us quite unexpectedly. And it can shake us and unsettle us. But at the same time, its problem is it's tantalizingly enjoyable. And that's the tension. But the problem is, you see, lust dehumanizes the other person. It makes them an object. It makes them a non-person. It exploits somebody else. It demands possession. It distorts relationship. It wants what excites me, not what is good for them. It cheapens sex. And is, says Jesus, the mother of adultery. And verse 30, left unchecked, it may take a person to hell. So, what do we do? What do we do? Well, for a start, we can be honest. See, some people may not say that they find this a very big issue, but many do. And I suspect more of us than let on do. So we can begin to be honest. Because the reality is Christian people, Christian leaders have affairs. They go over the boundaries with people they're counseling. They think sexual thoughts that they would die rather than have made public in their Christian congregations or families. They get drawn into pornography and all sorts of things. Now, there may be some hormonally supercharged 20-something here who says, well, it's all right for you, Turner. You're happily married, and at 47 and a half, you're probably virtually past it anyway. But let me tell you this. Marriage is no surefire cure-all for sexual sin. I wish it were. Jesus is talking here primarily to the married. And the problem of impure sexual thinking doesn't just vanish because you're married. See, if you're lustful as a single person, the chances are you'll be lustful in your marriage. Adultery wouldn't be an issue at all if married people had this all sorted out. They haven't. So we're all vulnerable, married or single. And we're all at risk. And we need to acknowledge that. And perhaps we need to stop being quite so punitive and judgmental and hard on one another when we know that others are struggling or failing. So first, we can be honest. But second, and this is Jesus' key point here, we must be ruthless. See, that's really Jesus' point, I think, in verses 29 and 30. He's not advocating here some sort of crude self-mutilation. Some early believers went down that route, pious people in the early church, who believed that they could take all this literally. But how absurd! How absurd! As if a blind person or a one-eyed person couldn't lust. As if a physically handicapped person doesn't have sexual desires or passions. How absurd! No, Jesus' point is surely just this: know yourself. Deal drastically with anything in your own life that is feeding lust. There may be places you shouldn't go, ways in which you shouldn't touch other people, things you shouldn't look at, circumstances in which, for example, being away from home, you need to be especially careful. So what for you, this is the question as I ask myself, what for you are the lust-feeding places, people, things, situations, activities? Is it books, magazines, the internet, chat lines, films, late-night TV? Is it a mixed flat, certain parties, too much time alone with somebody, just going too far physically in a relationship? Is it just too much time on your own with no outlets for friendship and other activities? Well, I don't know. I know where some of the danger areas are for me. But what are yours? We don't legislate for one another on these matters. Of course not. There's no universal checklist that I can hand you as you leave church tonight. Because the issue is ultimately about the mind. It's an internal issue rather than an external issue. But Jesus says to us, all know your danger zones. They'll all be different. But know your danger zones and then don't mess with lust. Don't mess with it. Hate it. Don't flirt with it or pamper it. Don't enjoy nibbling at its edges. Hate it. Crush it. Dig it out. It's drastically serious and you can come badly unstuck. So we experience a measure of social and cultural amputation rather than allow our eternal destiny to be endangered. That's what Jesus seems to be saying here. And it's hard. It's hard because, frankly, a lot of these things we enjoy. And that's the rub, really, with some of this. But, you know, we're not on our own in all this. Be honest, be ruthless, but also be practical, because we're not on our own. This isn't just a sort of say-no mentality. This isn't just Christians banging on negatively about sex. No, far from it. There's a saying yes dimension here too. There's a saying yes to God in honest thanks for the sexual beings we are. There's a saying yes to God for that sexual enjoyment of one another that is pure and right and true. There's a saying yes in thanks to God and in prayer, asking him to channel our powerful sexual feelings. See, we don't need to be out of control in this area any more than we need to be out of control in the area of anger or greed or any of the other things where we manage generally to keep ourselves in check. And if we're married, there's a saying yes to our marriages, praying, working, striving to make those marriages fantastic at every level. And then there are the networks of relationships within the Christian family itself, saying yes to God in thanks for the brother and sister relationships in the Christian family, which can and should, at their best, be sexually affirming and yet relatively free from the pressure of lust and an inappropriate sexual distortion. So that's the challenge. There's no magic formula here. And we need to help one another in this area, and we need not to be too hard on one another in this area. We're on a tightrope, aren't we, between positive affirmation of human sexuality and the destructive consequences of giving house room to mental adultery. And Jesus says it's as well to understand that and to live accordingly. Now, a bit about divorce. Because if you're married, lust is one form of adultery, unfaithfulness to your spouse. But, says Jesus here, and this is hard, easy divorce is another. These verses need to be seen and understood in their context. I know professionally and Christianly that divorce and remarriage are mighty sensitive and mighty painful issues for many, for increasing numbers of people, even in the church. See, about 4 marriages in 10... end in divorce, slightly more second marriages. 2 in every 5 marriages involves at least one divorced partner. And even in the church, we're seeing more couples divorce and later wishing to remarry. Now, this is a difficult debate. There are divergent views and approaches both across the denominations, down through church history, and even among people who love and submit to the Bible. There is not one absolutely clear mind here, and I haven't time, obviously, in the few moments that are left, to do justice to these important and sensitive issues or to grapple with all the pastoral dilemmas which flow from some of this debate. But I just want to concentrate on one or two of the things that Jesus seems to be saying in this little snapshot, and what he's saying also in the longer passage where he deals with this in Matthew 19. It might be worth glancing just for a moment on to Matthew 19. Jesus here starts the argument really in Deuteronomy 24:1, and that's what is quoted back in chapter 5. There was a debate at the time between 2 groups of Pharisees, named after their respective main men. The Shammai school said that a man could only divorce his wife for sexual unfaithfulness. The Hillel school, on the other hand, said no, divorce could be for any matter, and that in the event could be quite trivial. All you needed was, in fact, the right sort of paperwork, a get, which you could hand your wife, saying, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and off she went. And that was the end of it. Now, when in Matthew 19, verse 3, the Pharisees come to try to trap Jesus, they say, Jesus, in effect, are you an any-matter supporter of divorce? Are you easy on divorce, or are you hard on divorce? And they try to trap Jesus. And he makes 5 points, I think, either directly or by implication, which maybe help us in today's climate. Because, you know, today's climate is not that different to the divorce climate of the first century. The first thing that Jesus does is he endorses the permanence of marriage. Do you see that? He points them back to Genesis 1 and 2 and asks incredulously, verse 4, if they have not read those chapters. Well, we read part of them earlier tonight. God's intention is lifelong, monogamous, one flesh union. It is intended to be indissoluble. two become one in a strange and awesome mystery. Verse 6, they're no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. Here, friends, is the only conceivable, acceptable, realistic mindset with which anyone should enter a marriage. It's the only mindset anybody should even think about marriage. So that's point one. Jesus endorses the permanence of marriage. Point two, he recognizes that divorce and remarriage are not impossible, but they are always exceptional. You see, if, as Malachi says, God hates divorce, why does he make provision for it? Chapter 19, verse 8. Moses permitted you to divorce because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. See, divorce is never, we can say on the authority of Scripture, divorce is never what God wants, but in a fallen world, it's a tragic reality where hearts will not change. And it seems likely that if Jesus considered a divorce in exceptional circumstances valid, then very likely he considered a remarriage following that, in those circumstances valid, and in his contemplation. Thirdly, marriage should survive even something like adultery, if at all possible. In chapter 19, verse 7, the Pharisees said that Moses commanded divorce. For indecency. Jesus says, no, you've got that wrong. He merely allowed it. The Pharisees tried to say that adultery made divorce compulsory. No, Jesus says, no, it's merely allowable. The aim is, above everything, to save savable marriages. And then, as now, Jesus expects us, friends, to move heaven and earth to keep our marriages going and to support and honor one another's. The fourth point is that in some divorces, there may be an innocent partner. See, who is to blame? Back to chapter 5. Who is to blame? For the situation that the Lord talks about in verse 32. Who is the guilty party here? Isn't it the husband who divorces without good reason? And who's the victim? Isn't it the wife who is made an adulteress? See, there's all the difference in the world between things which undermine happiness in a marriage and things which break the marital bond. That's where things were going wrong in Jesus' day. It had all got too easy. And in fact, says Jesus, it's only something as marriage-destroying as porneia. That word in verse 32, which the NIV translates marital unfaithfulness, in the sexual arena. It's only something as marriage-destroying as that which can begin to be a real basis for divorce. And when a husband or wife separating and remarrying in those circumstances is not sinning against the seventh commandment. And Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 seems to regard ultimate desertion by an unbelieving partner as another acceptable ground. Adultery destroys the exclusivity of the sexual relationship. Desertion makes it impossible to maintain the interpersonal allegiance which is at the very heart of marriage. These two grounds seem to be clearly taught and established in the Bible. The difficulty comes, and here even conservative Christians disagree among themselves, about whether these are the only legitimate grounds or whether they illustrate, in effect, the enormity of the sort of breakdown which is genuinely and demonstrably irretrievable. And which we might also see, for example, in a case of serious domestic violence or persistent emotional abuse. Well, there are no easy answers. To a society which demands divorce and remarriage as a right, Jesus' teaching here seems harsh and reactionary. But to those in the church who say there can never be divorce or remarriage, Jesus' teaching seems realistic, if heavy-hearted, provision for those serious catastrophes, which can overtake some couples. What is beyond argument is that Jesus utterly condemns people walking away from their marriages or any sort of easy divorce. He doesn't pull his punches. It is frankly adulterous. And the challenge to us is to try somehow failingly to uphold that standard. And some of you know here only too well how difficult and painful and costly at a personal level that can be. And that's really my last point. It's the fifth point. Divorce is not an unforgivable sin. No sin is unforgivable except the repudiation of the work of God, the Holy Spirit, in our lives. Hearts do get hardened. Marriages die. People lose hope. Children are lastingly damaged by divorce. It's a mess. But you know, God is extravagantly generous to those who mess up their lives. And if you don't believe me, look at how he spoke to a female adulterer he caught red-handed in John chapter 8. God is extravagantly generous to those who mess up their lives. And what better a place to be making that final point than at a communion service? Because, you know, divorce leaves debris. And many of you know that. And lust, too, can leave us guilt-ridden and anxious. Jesus understands. He wouldn't have taught about these intimate issues if he hadn't understood. He knows that our lives are often messy, but he sets the standard for us to which we can aspire and for which we can long. And, you know, there's only one way back for any of us in any situation of sin. And that's through the cross and the forgiveness that's available here in the death of Christ. And that's where we find forgiveness for all our sins, including the mental and actual adulteries that spoil the church and the world. Let's remain in an attitude of prayer as we come to the communion.